to those of you who may have joined us on the telephone. So please take a seat either around the table or in the back, although the table seats are give precedence to the ESSAC members, but I think we do have enough seats at this point for everyone who wants to sit up at the table. We'll be starting shortly. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. This is the public meeting of the Security and Stability Advisory Committee. We're going to go ahead and start. What I'd like to do first is to welcome everyone here. Today is Thursday, the 23rd of June, here in Singapore. And welcome those of you who are on the telephone. We are going to record this session, just so that everybody is aware of that. And I'm going to ask Edward to go ahead and please start the recording and let me know when it has started. Thank you very much. The recording has started. Welcome, everyone. And before we get going, perhaps we could, before I turn it over to Patrick Falstrom, the chair of the ESSAC, I'd just like to go ahead and do a roll call in the room and also on the telephone for the purpose of the recording, just so that we know everyone who is here. I am Julie Headland, ICANN staff, and I support the ESSAC.
Rod Rasmussen, APWG.
Dave Piscatello, ICANN.
Sheldon Lee, Dacian.
Russ Mundy, ESSAC.
Warren Kamari, Google.
Steve Sheng, ICANN staff, and also support for ESSAC.
Actually, it would be good if people told if they are members of ESSAC or not. Patrick Feldstrom, ESSAC chair.
Jim Galvin, ESSEC Vice Chair. And let me just comment, the folks in the back, the table is not restricted to ESSEC members. Feel free to step up and join. Plenty of room, and there's power up here, too. Thank you.
Medica Keo, member of ESSEC.
Vandis Cartesini, ESSEC member.
Don Blumenthal with Public Interest Registry. I'm not a member of ESSAC.
Steve Metalitz here on behalf of the Coalition for Online Accountability, and I'm not a member of ESSAC.
Matt Larson, member of ESSAC.
And those members who are, and those people who are joining at the table, if you could grab a mic and introduce yourselves, that would be helpful too.
Rick Lamb, ICANN.
John Demko, webnames.ca, not a member of ESSAC.
Dave Baker.nz.
Debbie Monaghan.nz.
Mikey O'Connor, worst dressed at the conference and co-chair of the DSSA.
Pedro Vega from .pt of Portugal, not a member of ESSAC.
Brendan Gerbis, Syracuse University, not a member of ESSAC.
Salve Vodea, ICANN staff.
Julie Hammer, AUDA board member and member of ESSAC, AUDA, not a member of this ESSAC.
Good morning. I'm not sure. I'm a member of the ICANN board. I'm the technical liaison group.
And do we have anybody on the telephone? Hearing no one, what I'd like to do at this point then is to turn the meeting over to Patrick Falstrom. Patrick?
Thank you very much, Julie, and thank you everyone for... I move a little bit closer to the microphone there. And no, the cable's really good. Oh, you see?
You're right.
Now something happened.
No, I've done it. Okay.
Okay, welcome everyone to this meeting of ESSAC, and thank you very much for coming up this early in the morning. Let's see if we can get the slides up.
Something very technical. Good thing we have your technical expertise. Thank you. Checking the cable is always a good idea. Full screen.
So what we'll do, what we have planned to do is to divide this into this 1 hour session in two 30 minute portions. The first one, we're thinking of going a little bit quickly through three different publications from ESSAC that we think is worth actually noticing you about it, and so you have the ability to ask questions. And then on the second half, thank you, Julie, on the second half we will have a little bit longer discussions, 50 minutes each, on work that is currently going on. And we would like to have the ability to discuss that.
I can move ahead to the overview.
Yeah, can you go to the next, please?
There we are.
Mm-hmm. So if we look at the documents that we published lately, we have number 47, which are comments from ESSAC on the GTLD Readiness Transition Process Model, which has to do with what happens when a registry is going away, the interaction between registries and emergency failover registry. Number 48 on orphan glue that we'll hear more about, and the same thing with the zone risk and also the advice on blocking. Next slide, please. Currently, we are working on source address validation. We are continuing that work. We are looking at the WHOIS taxonomy that you will hear more about. We are participating in the internationalized registration data working group that will meet, by the way, immediately after this meeting in this very room, if I remember correctly. Yeah, thank you, Julie. So if you're interested, you can just stay here, and the people that manage to get microphones and power and everything, just stay there, and you will have it also for the next hour. Except maybe me that is sitting where the chair of that group will sit. They will throw me away. We also have generic collaboration with the ICANN community, where the other constituencies are asking us questions and want to have discussion with us. Specifically, I can say that we started again to have meetings together with GAC. We had a whole meeting about blocking for 1 hour during this week, for example. We also do internal ICANN work, of course, that has to do with ESSAC itself. We have a membership committee that our vice chair, Jim, to my left, is chair of that group, where we are looking into the processes for looking at the membership and membership process for ESSAC itself. We're also participating in the other ICANN work, of course, which has to do with the budget, the strategic plan, et cetera, that we just initiated the work on the strategic plan for 2012 to 2015. I think that's all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's it.
So, if we go into a review and presentation of the work, I think
we'll switch,
first?
And I'll switch to. Yeah, it's 48.
The first one is SAC 48, comment, ESSAC comment on the definition of orphan glue in the draft applicant guidebook, and Steve Cheng will do that presentation. So I hand over to you, Steve.
Thank you, Patrick. On behalf of the Orphan Glue Work Party, which includes ESSAC members Roy Ahrens, Jeff Bezer, Jim Galvin, Jeremy Hitchcock, and Matt Larson, I'm giving this update to the in a public meeting. So in this work, ESSAC is considering a very specific issue in the guidebook. In the question 28 of the GAC, it states that a complete answer should include, but it's not limited to, a proposed measures for the management and removal of orphan glue records for names removed from the zone. So this is the particular question that ESSAC is considering. The committee has two general findings. The first finding, which I'll go over the second one, is the there's no clear definition of what orphan glue really means. And to that extent, ESSAC proposes a definition of orphan glue in this document. The second finding is there are varied policies regarding orphan glue across the registries. There are at least three types. The first type is direct registration of orphan glue is permitted. The second type, so the first type, this is more like the dot museum where you can directly register glue without any delegation. The second type is orphan glue is permitted until the last association is removed. So there are many many domains that refer using that name server, but the glue is not removed until the last association. And the last practice is the glue is simply not permitted. The orphan glue is not simply permitted. So the ESSAC make three comments. The first one is the phrase orphan glue is ambiguous because no definitive definition exists. And in this document, ESSAC actually proposed a documentation, a definition. The second one is orphan glue can be used for malicious purposes, but the dominant use is to support the correct and ordinary operation of the DNS. This naturally leads to the last comment and recommendation is to mitigate the actual abuse of orphan glue. So they should be removed when presented with evidence. So those are the three comments we have. So we submit the comment through the May version of the GTLD applicant guidebook, and these findings has been included in the guidebook by reference. The committee is looking to continue its study of the orphan glue and will provide a complete report that will include the definition of orphan glue, how it comes to existence, how it can be abused, and how it's managed. So that's all. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Steve, can you turn off your microphone? Maybe it's my microphone that is. So the microphone. Let's just move away.
So the next presentation is on SAC49 on DNS zone risk analysis. So we talked originally about having Dave Piscatello presenting it, but Jim Gallen will do the presentation instead.
Thank you, Patrick. So continuing in our series of trying to assist registrants in protecting domain name operations and the significance of its use in application, moving from what registrars can do to help protect domain name accounts to what registrants can do to help protect domain name abuse, protecting their account and access. The next step, of course, is looking at the use of your DNS data and your domain name services. So domain name resolution relies on zone data. This is the set of resource records that define the bindings between your names and your IP address is the most obvious thing. People talk about that all the time, but the DNS is used for can be used for other purposes too, between your services and obviously for certain kinds of aliasing also. And there are three kinds of servers that exist in the system for providing access to that data for the users of your DNS zone data. You have master servers that actually do the publication of the data that you put together. There are authoritative servers that get the data from that master, and then the authoritative servers make that available to the rest of the community. And then, of course, you have recursive servers, which will act on behalf of individual users, and they will reach out to authoritative servers in order to get that data so they can return the information to you. It's important to understand these are roles. In fact, in some cases and in some configurations, some of these roles can be combined, but they are actually three distinct roles in the DNS architecture and system. Next slide, please. So who provides the authoritative name service? This is an important question because it determines the quality of the risk that you're exposed to as a registrant in providing your DNS services. There's obviously going to be a DNS hosting provider, and the different categories of people that can be a provider. One, of course, you could be doing it for yourself. Some people, most large enterprises, of course, provide their own DNS services for themselves. But many registrants, probably most, actually use third parties. In many cases, that's even the registrar, who by default often provides name services for you. But there are many other authorized third parties who specialize in DNS services that you might use for one reason or another. So down here at the bottom, we have the example of a registrar who might bundle DNS services with their registration services, which is their core service. You could have an ISP who might provide you with some DNS services as part of their core network services. And then, of course, web hosting providers, if they provide a different core service, and they might also bundle DNS services. So these are just examples of the different kinds of authorized third parties that you might have providing your DNS service. Next slide, please. So how is it that a registrant goes about publishing this zone file? How is it they go about getting their data into the master server that's going to make it available to the rest of the internet? In the first situation here, the registrant might, in fact, compose the zone file themselves and publish it on their own master server. In this kind of scenario, the registrant would know all of the resources and bindings that are in their zone file. So they have complete knowledge of what the DNS service is providing for them in terms of their access to, in terms of what they're providing to the internet community for access to their zone data. Next slide. The next situation is where a registrant might provide some of the data. So through some kind of out-of-band or DNS hosting provider submission form, you would provide some small amount of data, and then the hosting provider would actually provide the rest of the data. So for example, you log into your registrar account. If that's who's bundling your services, you provide them with the domain names, the second and third level names that you want to use, and if you are a hosting provider, if you're using them also to provide your web services, they'll automatically fill in what the IP address is. So you have access to some of the data. You might not know what the rest. Next slide, please. The problem that we are approaching here with this document on zone risk is to make the specific observation that a registrant who doesn't know everything that is in their zone file is at risk of their DNS services not working or being interrupted for some reason. And you have no ability to restore that name service. If you don't know everything that's in that file, then if you need to move that service, then you just don't have the ability to do that. And obviously your DNS service is critical to your presence on the internet. It is the way in which everybody finds everything that you have to offer to that user community. Next slide, please. So name service is a critical and essential service. Any circumstance where your name resolution might be interrupted becomes a threat, and you're at risk of not being able to serve your user community. Next slide, please. There are some ordinary circumstances under which this might occur, and it's important to keep that in mind. People always think that something malicious has to happen, but you could just have a technical or business failure of your hosting provider. Just an ordinary situation that might happen. The circumstances aren't really important. If you don't have access to the data, then you simply cannot restore it. Okay? Your account could be compromised. And in this case, this is one way in which sometimes hackers can do hijacking. So if they can get into your account, they can change your name services and thus prevent you from getting access and restoring your service too. And sometimes you can just have unintentional misconfiguration. I mean, especially if you're managing your own services, you can make mistakes. Next slide. So we have here a set of recommendations for registrants to think about, things for them to keep track of when creating and knowing about their DNS service in particular. So you should actually, the most important step here is documenting your architecture and its operations. This may require that you need to get some amount of information from your hosting provider, but you should be aware of how the system works and what you have available to you, and including your registrar. You want to design for resiliency and actively manage your DNS information. So you want to make sure that you know where your services are being provided and keep track of what that information is. You want to know even the information that you would not ordinarily provide, which might be defaulted by your hosting provider. You want to make sure that you get a copy of that too and keep track of it. The protecting your domain registration, hosting accounts, and monitoring your name services, this goes back to some advice that ESSAC has given before in prior documents when we provided advice to registrants about how to protect their domain name registration. Developing a continuity plan is very important. People overlook the significance of their name service. And so making sure that you have an archive and a record of all of your zone risk information and keeping track of that, and then actually, if you're going to have a continuity plan, it's important to exercise that. So you should have that plan, and you should determine whether or not you can actually bring your resolution service back if you need to. Next slide, please. The usual principles that apply for any kind of third-party hosting service. I mean, your DNS service, again, you need to recognize it as a critical internet service, and you need to do fairly straightforward things that you would do for any kind of critical service, making your informed choices. Okay, take note of how your data is managed, who has access to it, who can make changes. Be sure to check the capacity, your security measures, monitoring. Most providers will provide you with some kind of communication about what's going on. And service level agreements so that you can ensure that services continue when you need them to. Next slide. So now that we have this report, this is part of our outreach. We want to share that report more directly with the community. We're sharing it here as a start, and we'll begin to do that more. We'll make presentations to a larger community. And we will continue to study specific issues with respect to DNS hosting. This particular document does not deal with DNSSEC too much, and so that's an issue for further study. And I believe that's it.
Thank you very much, Jim. And then we're moving directly into the next report, which I will do, which has to do with the latest advisory that we presented Saturday, just a few days ago, which is on blocking. So next slide, please. I'll try to do this quickly so you have the ability to ask questions in all three of these first slides before we move into the next section. So the background that we describe in the document is that blocking or altering responses to DNS is already happening. And the approach that these kind of blocking or alternation activities is having is to actually ensure that it has the intent that a certain effect is supposed to happen for the users that actually do the lookup. That in turn is also intended to happen within a given administrative domain, for example, at your own home, inside your own firewall, or inside the area of, for example, an enterprise that is doing filtering in a firewall scenario or something. Next slide, please. If it is the case that, for example, resolution of a domain name into an IP address is prevented, in that case, that, of course, prevent the immediate connection to the named host, but it's very easy to circumvent that, for example, by putting up another record which have a different name that maps to the same IP address or to access the IP address directly. Next slide, please. So what we describe in this document is that the very common engineering principles that are used is to try to come up with a policy that actually, as surgically as possible, solves the problem that is intended to solve, which includes to not only solve the problem but also affect the users and not more than the ones that you intended to have the effect imposed on. So there is in general a concerted effort to do no harm to networks or users outside that policy region. Next slide, please. So the general recommendation is to consider the possible harm that the intervention might cause before actually start doing that, and not to affect internet users outside the organization's policy domain. Next slide, please. So the conclusion is, though, that all technical approaches to DNS blocking and other kind of alternational results will impact security and or stability of users and applications, and will have impact on coherence and universal resolvability of the namespace, which is talked about in many other documents by the Internet Architecture Board, Internet Society, and other organizations. Those are just examples. On the other hand, given that this is always happening, it is already in use, and there is some legitimate use to actually do these kind of blocking alternation activities, the SI cannot draw a good line between good blocking and bad blocking with the help of DNS. Instead, we suggest and strongly recommend people to actually evaluate what approach to the blocking is likely to create the fewest unintended consequences and least harm outside the block domain. We also point out, as I mentioned quite quickly in the beginning, that blocking on DNS name is not really blocking the access to the information which you access by using the name. And that is also something to remember, that quite often people talk about blocking and do blocking to solve the problem, but the actual blocking activity do not solve the problem that people want to solve. Instead, other measures should be used. Next slide, please. And that's it. Good. Thank you. So those were the sort of three which we think pretty important documents that we produced lately, and would like to give the ability for people to ask questions about those three, although you have to use this microphone, so I will run around. Okay, thank you. So, Julie, if it is the case that you have a question to ask on any of those three documents or any of these four, actually, that we have, or anything else, please raise your hand and you will get the microphone. And then we'll move into the two other more discussion items. Anyone have anything to ask about of these things? No, you have to raise your hand. Julie will come to with the microphone, and then you speak into the microphone. We have an interesting policy here.
It's very brave, man. It's a very brave man who stands between me and a microphone at ICANN, isn't it?
That's why we give you one.
My name is Marilyn Cade. I'm the chair of the business constituency, and it really is a question, but it's probably somewhat naively posed. Most of what I do with my time is travel around the world and work with governments who have certain concerns about the impact of a number of activities online, let me use that term rather than on the internet, online that are affecting their citizens. And blocking looks like, as you know, particularly you from the technical community, blocking looks like a easier solution than and a quicker fix to some of the complaints they get. Does the ESSEC have an idea in mind already about, so yes, you issue a paper, but and people can read the paper, but is there another layer of activity that involves, that might develop, that involves sort of factual information that can be digested by policymakers?
There are some activities going on and discussion that also we at ESSEC and also a subset of ESSEC members are having that kind of discussion with law enforcement agencies, and specifically Dave Piscatello, raise your arm so people know who you are, is working quite a lot on working very hard on trying to find a way of interact with the people that actually do the real work in the world, so that in a future sort of future description is possible to describe more precisely on how to do. One thing that we had, as I said, a 1 hour discussion with GAC on specific blocking. So this presentation that I did now, I did a 30-minute version of it, and then we have 30 minutes of discussion. And this was one of the questions that came up. So if this is stupid, what are we doing, etc. In that discussion, what we came up with is that we recommended from ESSEC, what we talked about is that, first of all, if it is the case that, for example, a government or a policymaker talk about, well, we should block using the domain names, the first thing that we said at the meeting as an informal advice is to absolutely separate between the two cases where, one, the string itself is sensitive, and the policymaker want to make it impossible to actually use that string. And the second case, where the policymaker want to make it impossible to access the information which is referred to with that string. Given that you first of all have made up your mind on which one of these two cases we talk about, then it is possible to move into more fine-grained discussion on what to do, what kind of things can be done to create least harm. Okay. What the reaction that I personally got at the meeting and when I talk to policymakers around the world is that to start with, the policymakers and the ones that are sort of pushing for filtering and DNS, they, to start with, they are not even there. They have not even done the separation between whether the string is sensitive or whether they want to try to prohibit access to the information sort of the domain name is referring to. So I think that is, so to answer your question was a very long explanation, but I think the discussion has started. It is not done in only one location, but it's very, very early in the process. On the other hand, we do have good discussions between law enforcement agencies and ISPs and others, which are doing blocking on various layers in the protocol stack to solve the actual real problems we have on the internet. And I would like to hand over to Dave now. Thank you.
Dave Piscatella, ICANN. Marilyn, there is actually a technical paper that is probably not what you're looking for. I just wanted to bring people's attention to the fact that it was written by Steve Crocker, Dave Dagon, Dan Kaminsky, Danny McPherson, and Paul Vixie. The easiest place to find it is Krebs on Security. You have read it. It sounds, if I understand you correctly, you're looking for something that is a little bit more instructional to you know, to people in governments, in business, and you know, in the political arena, that perhaps is not as technically in depth as that paper, and that is something you might want ESSAC to pursue.
But I can repeat what Marilyn said for the recording. You said digestible. Wait.
But again, you're specifically suggesting that ESSAC try to find that, you know, that digestible piece of literature. And that's fine. I just, you know, you could ask us. You know, we could say no. But
yeah. One way that we are working in ESSAC more and more is that we are, while Julie's running around the room, you will get good training. One of the ways we work in ESSAC, which we also told GACVER explicitly, is that we don't mind having informal discussions, just like this one, just like the one we had at GAC. But we see a big difference between informal discussions and when we actually give advice, like these ESSAC documents. And to be able to produce the advice, we actually would like to have an as precise question as possible. So if you want us to work on something, please try to phrase in a question, because then we also know when we think we have answered it. Thank you.
Steve Metallitz. I think, Patrick, that maintaining the distinction you just cited between the informal discussions and the formal paper, such as the advice that you just described, is extremely important. And I think it's worth emphasizing, my understanding, because of the way it's addressed in the ESSAC 50, that the paper that Dave referred to is not an ESSAC paper, even though it is authored by the longtime chairman of ESSAC, among others. This, I could speak from my 12 years of experience with ICANN. There's often been a very blurry line between the activities of the ESSAC and the activities of some or a group, a subset of ESSAC members, and who's speaking for whom. I think that that's always been a problem, and I think it's going to become a much more acute problem in the years ahead. And if you heard so many references on our opening day to the importance of very clear disclosure and ethical rules and really making clear who's speaking on behalf of what, I think the ESSAC 50 paper is a very good contribution and will be very helpful. But I would really caution against moving, against ESSAC taking on what Dave referred to, which is to take a paper written not on behalf of ESSAC and somehow build on that, mark that up.
Yes.
I think that would be you've got to be very careful before doing that.
Let me answer on behalf of Dave. I don't think that was Dave's intention at all. But one of the reasons why we do feel comfortable referencing that paper also in this discussion is because as part of the work with the SAC 50, as you see in the document, we do reference that document, which means that ESSAC has made a conscious decision to reference that document, which means that we, even though we have not authored it or written it, we have made a decision that we think that is a good background document. So it has reached that level at least, which is, but you're absolutely correct, it's not an ESSAC document. Let's try to 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. Do you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, good. So let's try to use these microphones again. So, but you're absolutely right. But on the other hand, we are trying. This is sort of the process issues we are working with, because ESSAC historically has produced only 4 documents a year, we have been sort of lucky and worked very hard to produce 4 documents so far this year. We don't want to stop the informal discussions because sometimes those are needed as well. But you're absolutely right that we need to be much, we can always be better, let me put it that way, on being clear on what kind of statements anyways, we have 20 minutes left, and I really would like to give time to the two work parties that we're thinking about discussing, and we start with the source address validation, and Marike, please.
Good morning, everyone. So the source address validation work party is chaired by me and has been ongoing for for a while. So next slide, please. So what actually is source address validation? Primarily, these are techniques to verify that the source IP address of packets submitted to the internet are valid. And what is meant by that? First off, that they're not assigned from private address space, and also that they fall within a range of legitimately advertised prefixes for a given origin. And there are many developed techniques, since this is not a new issue. So bogon filtering is one thing that is primarily used by ISPs, or unicast reverse path forwarding. Next slide, please. And why is this actually important? It's very important because these techniques mitigate spoofed IP packets, which are very commonly used for many attacks. So denial of service attacks, spam campaigns, and impersonations of originating host. Now, these were extremely prevalent about a decade ago. But we decided to resurrect this issue to see whether or not there were any new nuances that we needed to look at. So next slide, please. So there's a slew of prior work. In IETF, there's a best current practice 38, which primarily specifies how to do ingress filtering. There was a very early SAC document, SAC 004. And then a bunch of other documents that have been written to enumerate the usefulness of you know, doing source address validation. Next slide, please. So the current SAC activity surrounding this is we're studying existing prior work, and we also realize that sometimes there's a confusion in terms of terminology, what is actually meant by the terms egress or ingress filtering. We were taking a look at filtering that is actually being done by ISPs, studying new developments in source address validation techniques. So in the IETF, there's actually specifically a source address validation working group that was formed. Also, we wanted to debunk some myths, you know, because, you know, about a decade ago when people started utilizing some of these techniques, there were bugs in code, there was complexity that wasn't clearly understood. So we wanted to kind of get a level set of, you know, are people using these techniques? If not, why not? And should they be using them? So we wanted to study the costs and benefits of a holistic approach. I think that's the last slide. So where this working group primarily stands right now is that within the SAC, we've been discussing while we realize that these techniques and the document as it currently stands really would benefit ISPs mostly, you know, how is it relevant to the ICANN constituency? And one of the things that we've been trying to do is address specific problems that the ICANN constituency has. So we're now at the point where we're trying to ask the questions from people, you know, such as yourselves represented here, to see how is it relevant to any of the work or policy that you're creating, and, you know, should this work, you know, what is it that you may need from this kind of work for source address validation?
Anyone? Yeah, Marilyn, please.
Thank you for that great presentation. And you, so I guess I should say again, Marilyn Cade, and you actually probably just created a lot more work for yourself, since I'm going to want to invite you to come brief the business constituency. But maybe we could do that jointly with the ISP, and we might be able to do it with the three constituencies, the across the commercial stakeholder group. You know, I think many of the attendees, that the people from our constituencies who come to the meetings, they won't necessarily be the right person to interact with, because it's not the enforcement teams who come. But the enforcement teams who are dealing with these kinds of problems, of course, are interfacing with whoever is coming to our constituency. So I think what we need in order to be responsive is going to be a one-pager that describes what the purpose of the interaction is and the kind of information that you're looking for that we could distribute and maybe arrange an online interaction with more of the technical teams back home, for probably both for the ISPs and the BC members who have, particularly the large ones, who have typically more complex teams embedded in the corporation. Would that be maybe a good way to start?
Yeah, I think that would be wonderful, because one of the things that the working group also has really wanted to do was actually do the outreach and see whether or not there's a real problem that needs to be solved. So I absolutely welcome that.
Anyone else have any input on this topic? In that case, let's move to last discussion point. The last discussion point on the we don't know. It's one of the two. Microphones, we obviously should, at least we here should just press the button, nothing else. So, last presentation on the WHOIS taxonomy, which also might move us in an interesting way into the next session. Jim, please.
Okay, next slide, please. So obviously WHOIS has been talked about a lot in the ICANN community, and it's being talked about a lot more these days because of the WHOIS review team. ESSAC itself has, over the years, issued 5 advisories that say something about WHOIS and WHOIS information, WHOIS data, protocol, that kind of thing. Next slide, please. One of the questions that comes up a lot is, what is WHOIS? And this is a very important question, and really the primary driver and motivation for this short comment on WHOIS that we wanted to put out there. It's a single term, but in fact it has multiple meanings. The first and most obvious meaning, of course, is for the protocol. WHOIS is actually the word which is used to describe the technical protocol that's used to access the information that's out there and that is collected. Second thing that it's used for, of course, is the information itself, the conceptual database of that domain registration data. People talk about WHOIS data, WHOIS information, the WHOIS database. They don't always put that extra qualifier on it, which is part of the reason why there's confusion. And then, of course, domain registration data that is collected for ICANN-accredited registrars and registries, you're obliged to make it accessible to the public. And most of the CCNSOs and their corresponding registrars also make some amount of that information available too, although they're not obligated to in the same way that the accredited counterparts are. So the main point here is that this ambiguity leads to confusion in discussions, and of course it hampers any kind of consensus that might come from these discussions. Next slide, please. Another part of the gap analysis in considering this issue that we did was realizing that there are varying implementation strategies. And so this means that from the user point of view, you get very inconsistent experiences. Some of this is related to deficiencies in the WHOIS protocol itself. You have no standards to signal messaging codings. This prevents any kind of presentation of internationalized information. No standards for signaling errors. It's kind of an on or off. There's no gray. No opportunity for additional information. The data displays vary according to the service provider. Different registries, different registrars don't do exactly the same thing. Now, accredited registries and registrars are obligated by contracts, but it turns out that it's different even for registries and registrars in those contracts. And, of course, there's no support for access control, which gets us into all of the discussions about whether or not the data should be public or not. Different communities have different needs of that data. And, the default at the moment is it all has to be available in order to serve these varying needs. Next slide, please. Then there's the question about what exactly is WHOIS data, what constitutes registration database, the data model. And there are at least three definitions of WHOIS data. The EPP, Extensible Provisioning Protocol, has its own definition included as part of that protocol specification in the IETF. ICANN accredited registry and registrar contracts separately include a definition of WHOIS data. There's a specification as to what you have to collect. And, of course, nothing addresses the lack of internationalized registration data support. Next slide. And there are a variety of uses of the WHOIS protocol. This gets to the directory services issue here. There are different communities who have different reasons for needing access to whatever registration data turns out to be. I mean, you have operational issues where you want to get technical contact, diagnosing registration difficulties, and sometimes for law enforcement and intellectual property reasons, you just need to associate an identity with a domain. And there are different rules and legislation and laws that come to bear in different regions. Next slide. So we want to make a couple of specific findings, which we are going to document in this this soon-to-be-produced document. First, of course, is to recognize that the WHOIS services, as defined today by the protocol, do not meet the needs of the various user communities of WHOIS. And then, of course, a taxonomy of the elements of a domain registration system is essential in order to scope and focus discussions about what to do about WHOIS and what we do going forward. We believe that this is the critical element that will help us to come to consensus, is being able to separate the various kinds of discussions that need to occur about WHOIS. Next slide. So two specific recommendations. We need a taxonomy. We identify three things for this taxonomy. The data model, the directory service, which is what we normally think of today as the WHOIS, the presentation of the data and the access to that data. And then, of course, the underlying protocol that provides all of that. And we more specifically are suggesting and recommending that solutions for each of these be developed separately and, in fact, in a priority order enumerated above. So the data model needs to be the first thing that's done. It drives everything else. Next slide. And the last slide, we put a collection of the various references. In particular here are just the documents, the five prior documents that in which ESSAC has actually made WHOIS comments, and just wanted to put them all in one place, and they'll be included in this document too when it's published with an explanation of what's in them. And I believe that's it, so thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim. So we have a little bit more than 5 minutes, or people might want to be in time for the next meeting if you don't stay. But we have some time for some discussion on this WHOIS work. So anyone have any questions or in good input to the team, please?
This is Steve Metallitz. I'm a member of this the working group that's just been presented. And I think what's just been presented is very useful, that this taxonomy and clearer definitions will help. I, as someone who's been involved in these issues for many years, I'm not sure that's what's blocking consensus or making it impossible for us to achieve consensus, but it sure can't hurt if we talk more clearly about what we're talking about. I'm a bit concerned, though, that we need to make sure that we're keeping track of all the different trajectories that are in play here. We have this working group. We have in the GNSO, there's a WHOIS survey drafting team. There was a document generated by the staff a year or so ago, and now that's kind of being the basis for a survey of what, you had a slide about it, needs and who uses WHOIS, and we're trying to ask what features do you want to see in the service or do you think are essential for the service. So that's going on, and then of course, there was also a reference in the budget and operating plan to ICANN developing a protocol and shepherding that through the IETF, as I read it. So I just want to make sure that all of those moving parts are in coordination with each other, because I think it tends to add some confusion, and what we're trying to get here is some more clarity.
So thank you for that, Steve, and I agree. It is, I mean, we are trying to pay attention and look out and see what's going on. You're right, there has been a lot of activity. I think those particular activities that you mentioned are information gathering activities at the moment, and those kinds of things are always valuable. I mean, ultimately, we do need to have a focused discussion about what we need to develop and what we need to provide. We're making a specific suggestion here, and I think those activities will contribute to any future actionable items that come from this. So we're hopeful, but thank you.
Anyone else have any input or questions? I think the point that you made is extremely valuable, as Jim said, because one of the things that we are trying to always improve and work very hard on at the moment is, as I said earlier, to make sure that what we are saying in our reports, in the actual reports, but of course also the informal comments, are useful for the community, not only technically correct. And we can sit there and polish our ebony, whatever, horses or something. But the important thing is that the advice we give is useful. And that means that both the content must be useful and digestible, as Marilyn said, but also come in the right time. So the timing issue is also important, of course. And that's also why we're trying to communicate earlier in the process and communicate with the ones and stay in contact with the ones that are part of the target audience to ensure that we actually are not wasting our time on writing things that is not useful for people anyways. We have also, by the way, I can mention that I didn't mention earlier, we also started the project where we are trying to find a way of knowing or measuring afterwards whether our reports have been useful or not. And everything from just looking at how many downloads there are, but also simply by interviewing people and asking people what they think. So at the moment, we are listening very carefully on what kind of input from people or what they thought about our documents. So please let us know both when you think you like document or when you have suggestions on improvements for future work that we're doing. And if there is nothing else, in that case, I would like to thank you all for coming. And Julia, I think, is there anything else we need to
just ask if anybody on the phone had any questions? I don't know if there's anybody.
Good point. If there is anyone on the phone that have any questions, please speak up. In that case, thank you very much, and I close this meeting.
And thank you very much, Patrick, and we'll go ahead and stop the recording. Thank you.